Good evening.
Good evening.
I am Marjorie Matthews. I'm the only Sun Prairie raging granny. It's what it is. I don't think the grannies have ever been here to the library before. I know that because everybody says, oh, this is a nice library. So apparently they didn't know. Thank you for inviting us and for recording us and for showing up. And if you weren't familiar with the grannies, you will be by the time we're done with this evening. Here we have a copy of our book, newly published, called Listen to Your Grandmothers, Madison, Wisconsin Raging Grannies, Sing for Peace, Social Justice, Public Education, and Environmental Protection. And some other things, too. The book is vignettes. Each of us who were willing wrote a chapter about ourselves. It has photos. It has a CD with us singing. It's a great find. You might like to take one home. There's a table in the back there. Of course, that includes the CD for your favorite granny or grandchild or, you know, neighbor, whomever. We're going to read and sing and read and sing from the book and from our songs. The songs we're going to sing tonight are songs we have written. You'll know all the tunes, but you will maybe not know the words because we have put them together. We sing about war and peace, equality and inequality, protecting the environment, women's rights, civil rights, immigrants' rights, kind of a big deal right now, health care, the influence of money in politics, many issues of concern. So, Joy and I are going to play tonight. Deborah is going to conduct tonight. There are two songs that are sing-alongs. So if you got a little half sheet, there's an opportunity to join us on some of the courses and try out your granniness and see how that is. If you'd like, we are at the farmer's market every other Saturday morning.
Actually, whether they like it or not, we're there.
That's true. But if you really like us and you want to come hear more, we will be singing many more songs every other Saturday morning. And the next times are September 23rd, October 7th, October 21st. So it's kind of every other Saturday. We sing from 9:30 to 10:30. Right across the street from what used to be the Inn on the Park, and now I think it's just the Park. That's the corner of Main and Carroll. You can also like us on Facebook if you're into that. And without further ado, I think perhaps we should sing. So let us sing.
We're raging grannies, and you guys are all our friends. Through the rallies and the marches, we are buddies to the end. We are parents, we are teachers, we do every kind of work. Responsibility we don't shirk. Glory, glory, let's go protest. There's always something causing unrest. Be it healthcare, education, or a law that is not fair, we promise we'll be there. We sing for social justice and an end to all the wars, for equal rights for women and fair treatment for the poor. Wherever there's inequity, it meets with our dismay, and we stand with you today. Let's go protest. There's always something causing unrest. Be it healthcare, education, or a law that is not fair, we promise we'll be there.
Thank you so much for inviting us here this evening, and to each one of you for being here. We do much better when there is an audience. My name is Barbara Arnold, and I've been a Raging Granny since 2008. This gaggle of women that you see up here feeds my soul, and in multiple ways. First, I love play acting and street theater. Getting dressed up in outrageous outfits, if you look at our outfits, and singing for and with you is great fun. Second, I care very deeply about critical social justice issues facing all of us. And third, I have learned that activism in community is far more satisfying and intentional than trying to work toward the common good alone. My husband, Fred Arnold, and I were Peace Corps volunteers in Malaysia from 1965 until 1968. Here is one passage from my autobiography that, for me, captures our human fear of the unknown and the concept of transformative education. How can we confront the fear of the unknown? If we can learn to hate, we can also learn to love. In Malaysia, living on the very conservative Malay East Coast, we immersed ourselves in Malay Muslim culture, which thrived on fishing and paddy farming. We lived in a kampong just 10 feet from where the men and women took splash baths 4 to 5 times a day. 50 feet from our house, which was built off the ground to allow breezes to circulate that hot, humid air, stood the village mosque. We grew to love and still miss the imam's haunting call to prayer 5 times a day. This cultural immersion awakened our consciousness of and sensitivity to another beautiful world religion. When we first arrived in country and traveled either on foot or on our Honda 50 motorbike, all the children en route would point at us and would shout, "Orang putih! Orang putih! Putih, putih, putih!" White person. I lived what it felt like to be perceived in a particular way simply because of the color of my skin. This experience transformed me in positive, constructive ways. I would never think of race issues in the same way again. Proximity may not always eliminate prejudice, but it can alleviate it. When the kids got to know us on a personal level, they laughed at and with us, melting some of that prejudice away. Andrew Solomon's moral imperative that young Americans, and I might say all Americans, travel and live in other countries and cultures to empathize with those who are different from us. Our next song is "Hide Away That Fear." One example of attempting to alleviate that fear is Nelson Mandela's well-known quotation from 1994. You may recall that recently, former President Obama tweeted Mandela's statement as the country reacted to the horrifying images and tragic violence erupting in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mandela's quotation: "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." This was true of my Peace Corps experience in Malaysia. Malaysia is just 500 miles from Vietnam, where, from 1965 to 1968, the number of U.S. troops was escalating daily. The Ken Burns, Lynn Novick series on the Vietnam War begins this coming Sunday evening on PBS. The series will demonstrate the relevance of our next song to our history in Vietnam. War is not the answer. It never was. It never will be. One line from the lyrics that you'll hear screams out at us. There is not one good thing war has ever achieved. Please listen to Hide Away That Fear.
Our fear so often makes us weak. Yet strength from love is what we seek. I still once war on fear they thrive. Their lust for war we must deprive. Ole! About defense, we're not naive. We've watched what wars cannot achieve. They don't bring peace, prosperity. For that, you need diplomacy. Ole! So don't be fearful now, don't ever, ever be deceived. There is not one good thing war ever has achieved. Won't allow a population to exist in peace. Where neighbors live and love and thrive and work and play. There's only suffering, pain and trauma every night and day. When mere survival is the goal for everyone. Full of fear and strife, let's end all war. Don't choose to fear, show courage please, and help the desperate refugees. They've lost so much, they had to flee. Do not scorn their humanity. Ole! We cannot bomb our way to peace, cause killing makes more enemies. Make peace, not war, to show we're great. Disarm fanatic fear and hate. Ole!
Hello. My name is Bonnie Block, and I'm not as well prepared as Barbara was, because I came in and Marjorie said, Andrea's sick, can you read? So here I am. Like many of you, I've done a number of different things in my life. Been a social worker, worked in Minneapolis with what was then called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. I've been a community organizer, I've been a lawyer, and I have been, I was 50, I pretty much focused on working for peace and justice organizations. I was with the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, which is one of the 16 denominational edge of the church groups. I chaired the National Council for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is an interfaith pacifist group that's over 100 years old now. I got tired of traveling, and so I staffed the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, which has over 150 groups throughout the state. Of faith-based people, union people, little local groups, affiliates of national organizations, all of them working for peace and justice. But I want to start with 2003, when my work for peace, I think, took a different direction that I frankly didn't expect would happen. But I would like to read from my piece in the book. In 2003, I joined the Madison Pledge of Resistance and started to engage in acts of nonviolent civil resistance opposing the second U.S. invasion of Iraq. I was arrested about a dozen times for sitting in at military and related sites and thus violating Madison's trespass organizations. But I paid the resulting fines in community service because the municipal judge, I think, sort of agreed with us. It was called, I called it catch and release. And then in December of 2011, a group of us, which has now become the Wisconsin Coalition to Ground the Drones, we started working at doing peace vigils against drone warfare, which is taking place here in Wisconsin, about an hour and a half north of here at the Wisconsin Air National Guard Base called Volt Field. We were protesting the training of the shadow drone operators. I've been arrested 3 times for crossing the line to deliver a letter, or trying to the commander. And we objected to his program, or this program, of remote control killing. Each time I paid the resulting fine. But in 2014, when I was arrested for leafleting at an open house at the base, and a jury found me guilty of trespassing, I refused to pay the fine because I believe we have a constitutional right to peacefully, nonviolently exercise our free speech, even on a military base. Instead, I served 5 days in the Juneau County Jail. And just like the AFDC mothers in Minneapolis decades earlier, the women in Pod A were also trapped in a broken system that served them poorly. Joining the Raging Grannies in 2007 has brought together many of the issues I've been working on for years. Peace, justice, the environment, speaking truth to power, and standing in solidarity with the powerless. Singing new words to old tunes that poke fun at our human foibles, and there are many, makes people laugh, creates sisterhood. You know, these are my sisters. And it's great fun. I love that we sing at all kinds of places, to all kinds of people, whether we've been invited or not. And that has included being arrested twice with 2 other grannies for unlawful assembly at the Solidarity Sing-Along in the Capitol Rotunda in 2013. So I'm proud to be a Madison Raging Granny and hope to be raging for many more years because, and I quote, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. The next song we're going to sing is called Standing in the Need of Single Payer. And I just want to say, you know, today Bernie Sanders introduced a single payer Medicare for All health plan. This song was written actually by one of the grannies in 2007. And I want you, when they start talking about we can't afford it, I want you to remember 2 numbers. We are spending, through the life of this particular weapon system, the F-35, you know, bomber, which we want to have at Oak Field, that's $1 trillion. And what we are doing in terms of, quote, refurbishing our nuclear weapons is $1 trillion. We could buy a whole lot of health care for that.
Right, I just want to invite you to sing along
with us, of course. I think you will recognize the tune and hope that you will join us. It's my mother and my father and the uninsured, standing in the need of single payer. It's my brother and my sister and the underinsured, standing in the need of single payer. We will rage and shout for single payer healthcare now. Everybody in and nobody out. Single payer healthcare now. From your birthday to your death day, you will get healthcare when we have a single payer plan. Single payer plan from retirement. pay or blend. We will rage and shout for single payer healthcare now. Everybody in and nobody out. Single payer healthcare now.
Hello. My name is Sheila Plotkin. I'm from McFarland. And I'm going to read a sort of a chain of events from my part in this book, because I've been on a very long journey. A lot of women my age have been on the same journey. I like to say I've been at least a dozen different people in my lifetime, and I'm still looking for the next one. In my early 20s, I bought a long-sleeved white blouse. The tag said it was washable, so I washed it. It emerged a wrinkled mess. I made my husband return it for me. I was certain the clerk would know that it was my fault. I couldn't face what I knew would be a confrontation. I hated being so afraid. In my late 70s, I challenge legislators to fulfill their responsibilities. I give speeches. I build websites and say what I think. I publish data that makes enemies. I write letters to editors. I write and sing songs of peace and justice. I give interviews. My name appears in mass media. I'm inspiring others to follow my lead, and I am no longer afraid of anyone. The 50 years between these two versions of myself, therein lies a journey of discovery and change. I am still a work in progress. I am not done yet. I went to school and took care of 2 kids and our small house, all while my husband worked in Washington, D.C. for 2 weeks at a time, coming home for a weekend and leaving again. I graduated in June 1968, cap, gown, and a child on each side, walking proudly toward the stage. I knew at that moment I could probably do anything that I wasn't afraid to try. 1978 marked a significant change, a surge in my self-confidence. A colleague and I testified in a case of sexual misconduct by a well-known Milwaukee judge. His attorney tried to trip me up on dates. I was as focused as I had ever been. The judge was removed from the bench. My political activism began with a postcard. In 2006, on the weekend before the McFarland Village Trustee election, someone mailed anonymous postcards naming the trustee they wanted ousted and lying about her. This was a clear violation of campaign laws. An incumbent trustee was a member of our group. He asked us to appear and support his resolution requesting that the Dane County DA investigate the postcards. When the vote was taken, the 4 trustees who benefited directly from those illegal postcards voted no. When the roll call finished and the last no vote was cast, I heard myself saying, "Shame on you, shame." So began the next phase of my personal reclamation project. I was beginning to find my voice. I discovered the Raging Grannies of Madison during the Wisconsin uprising in 2011. I watched admiringly from the sidelines for a couple of years and then joined them in 2013. They welcomed me with open arms. And once I felt comfortable, I began to write songs. The grannies bring out my fun-loving, creative self, and I love them for it. I am so proud to be one of them. Our next song is Conservation's Too Slow. The grannies do not deny climate change. We defy it.
What will we do now? Where will we go when the looters prevail? Don't you know that fossil fuel has got to go and our conservation's too slow? How can we wake our senators up before it's too late? Grannies and students, all of Earth's people, we must decide.
My name is Deborah Lofgren. I was born in 1950 and became one of the gazillion Debbies because of Debbie Reynolds' popularity. And I just wanted to read a little excerpt talking about when I walked into college. In college, I walked into the arms of the anti-war movement. And Students for a Democratic Society. My stepbrother was in Vietnam, and he sent me a letter saying it hurt him that I was so involved in this movement. His pain was not something I took lightly. It was another very difficult and emotional decision I had to face. I could not walk away and do nothing during this travesty. My conscience wouldn't let me. It did cause strained relations with several of my family members that took time to resolve. But we loved each other and we worked it out. I too want to say I am looking forward to seeing Ken Burns and his expose on the Vietnam War, what happened there, what happened here, and what we can learn from that. I managed to get a degree in education while being co-chair of SDS and traveling for the first time, being that I was from a farm in Racine County, to many cities for demonstrations and conventions. After a demonstration at the University of Chicago, federal agents contacted my father for information on how to find me. They said they wanted to question me about crossing state lines to incite a riot. Believe me, there was no riot. It was just a common harassment tactic that they used on many people. My father was caught by surprise, but he was astute enough to say that he didn't know where it was because we were estranged. My youngest brother, on my mother's side, has always ribbed me about what would have happened if they had contacted my mother. She would have been intimidated by their authority and given them my picture, my address, my phone number, and possibly birth certificate if they had asked for it. And as they were leaving, she would have run out and said, but you know, she was prom queen. This became a family joke that we shared over and over again. I was able to meet many wonderful activists like Pete Seeger and Dr. Benjamin Spock while working with the Peace and Freedom Party during Nixon's last presidential campaign. I learned to write and type leaflets, give speeches, act in dramatic street theater, and fight to defend myself when necessary. Okay, it says, I never destroyed property or harassed people who didn't have my same beliefs. Our leaflets were typed up and run off on an old mimeograph machine, okay, that we had in the basement. A fellow SDS member, whose grandfather was one of the lawyers for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, bought us a bullhorn. This was our most prized possession. You know, it was a very active time in my life. And I just happily danced in the streets of Madison, down on State Street, when it was announced that the US military was pulling out of Vietnam. Our next song is called I've Been Working for a Living. Growing up in the time that I grew up and seeing both the fight against the Vietnam War, the fight against the feminist fight to try and allow people to work where they wanted to work and to be paid for what they were worth. This was my education. Yeah, I got one from the University of Wisconsin, but I got more of an education from this. So our next song is called I've Been Working for a Living.
I've been working for a living all the livelong day. I've been working for a living, but I don't get an equal pay. Something's broken in the system that pays men more than me. Can't you hear the future calling? That men make lots more dough. It's time to blow our horns. Mothers, won't you guess that you make even less? Time to show our scorn. Something is the matter with employers happy to pay us L-E-S-S. Something is the matter with the mindset that makes this unjust mess. Gender pay gap is pervasive, it's enough to cause us tears. At the rate that it is closing, it will take 100 years. It's found in every occupation and every single state. Find a way that you can protest.
Hi, my name is Linda Robertson, and I think that I was slotted in this space after the Equal Pay for Equal Work song because I am probably best known in this community for the 40 years I spent practicing law here. And one of the things that I can say about all of this wonderful group of women is that we are all women with a past.
Yep.
And everybody has a story. And you've heard some of these stories tonight, but we are all of an age group where we did, as young people, go through the tremendous divisiveness in this society caused by the Vietnam War. And we did go through the second wave of the feminist movement, the first wave being the people who got women the right to vote, culminating with the 19th Amendment. But the second wave being the women in the 1970s who started thinking about questions like equal pay for equal work and why are women automatically excluded from certain professions and so on and so forth. And I was lucky because I got to the age where I started having to make real grown-up decisions about my life at a time when all of this was just coming to fruition. And so what I had learned as a child, which is that a woman could be a teacher, or she could be a nurse, or she could be a secretary. Suddenly there were all of these other options that were available. And I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about that time, because what I did was I went to law school. Now, I could tell you lots of stories about the sexism of law school, but you don't want to stay here all night. There are other women here who like to talk and want to talk. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the time after I graduated from law school, which happened in 1974. I had a brand new baby. And at that time, it was close to impossible for women to find a job in a law firm. The Law School Placement Service permitted firms to interview there and use their facilities, even when they said, we don't want to interview women. I sued them. We got that changed. But it didn't change in time for me. So when I graduated from law school, women like me hung out a shingle, or we went to work for the state or a corporation that had some kind of affirmative action guidelines that they had to follow. And I ended up serendipitously as a legislative attorney at the Wisconsin State Legislative Reference Bureau. So my job, folks, was writing laws. And the middle 1970s was a fabulous time to be a young progressive woman in Wisconsin, because we had Midge Miller, we had Mary Lou Munce, we had Katie Morrison, these phenomenal women legislators, and also some male legislators like Carl Thompson and Don Hanaway, who were feminists and believed in furthering the feminist agenda. So I was there at a great time because all of these phenomenal reforms were being spearheaded, and I got to write it down. I got to figure out what to say. I got to figure out how to change the statutes so that they would be fair. So one of my first assignments was drafting the Wisconsin Equal Rights Act. That was designed to bring Wisconsin law into conformity with the federal Equal Rights Amendment, which we were sure was going to pass. Right? We're still waiting. We are the generation of women who hold up those protest signs and say, I can't believe I'm still protesting this. That's one of those issues. But in any event, we didn't pass the Equal Rights Amendment, obviously, but we passed the enabling legislation. And it was fun to go through the statutes, also very informative, to go through the statutes from beginning to end and figure out what needed to be changed. I drafted Wisconsin's new sexual assault law that made sexual assault a crime of assault rather than a crime of sex. I drafted Wisconsin's Divorce Reform Act, the Displaced Homemakers Act, Wisconsin's Title IX for equality in educational opportunities, and importantly, the first several drafts of the Wisconsin Marital Property Reform Act. What a fabulous time to be able to be in the legislature. Well, by this time, my husband and I had two preschool-age daughters, and I needed work flexibility that being in the legislature, whenever it was in session, didn't permit. And I had the opportunity to enter private law practice in the family law area, where I could take to court the statutes I had written and tell people what I thought they were supposed to mean. Now, I don't want you to think that everyone paid attention to me, because they didn't. But I did kind of have a leg up on people who had been practicing law for years and years and years, because it was all new to them and it wasn't quite so new to me. And where experienced lawyers would otherwise have mopped the floor with me, I had a piece of information they didn't have and was able to go on, and I had a really good time. Sexism within the bench and bar was rampant. In my first interview for a law firm job, the partners asked whether my husband approved of my working, and they did not take my word for it. They went out and interviewed him separately to make sure it was okay. Meanwhile, I had to meet with their wives to see if I was a safe person for their husbands to work with. There was concern about whether I could handle the salty language that lawyers sometimes employ. And that's just funny because I cuss like a sailor and always have. And I didn't object to any of this. I was just happy to be considered because they'd never hired a woman lawyer, and I was just happy to be considered. So whatever it was, I was gonna do whatever it took to get that job. But as time wore on, those sexist attitudes wore thin. And more than once, I was told to take less in income because I had a husband, and the guys had to support their families. I was criticized for not getting involved with the country club or a service club like Rotary. I was busy with women's organizations, arts organizations, my daughter's Brownie Troop, my son's Cub Scout Den, the PTA. All of that was really demeaned. So I eventually felt that I needed a more comfortable working environment. I couldn't find one among the law firms in town. And finally, my sole female partner and I decided to strike out on our own. We opened our doors in 1993. We grew to become the largest family law practice in the state, providing parent-friendly working conditions for our employees and contributing through mentoring, writing, and teaching to the improvement of the practice of law. I taught a feminist approach to family law and marital property law at the law school for 25 years. I quit so that my daughter could have the place to herself. I thought I owed her that. And I've now wound up my practice and retired after a long and glorious ride. And I hope after helping many people move through a difficult time into a happier and more self-determined place, and making the legal community a more accepting place for women attorneys. So we've seen some changes, but as we know, there's a lot that still needs to be done. In recent weeks, I have been very obsessed, is probably a fair word, with what has been going on in the southern part of the United States with the hurricanes. I have a winter home in Hollywood, Florida. My daughter and her husband and my two grandsons are there. And I have been watching the Weather Channel 24/7. And so this next song means a great deal to me because it is about climate change. And it's written by our one Sun Prairie granny. Thank you.
Climate change. We've had to slow the rate of climate change. The situation's one of urgency, emergency. With short-sighted thinking, we'll see all coastlines sinking. Climate change. Good science tells us about climate change. We need to cut down use of fossil fuels, set up new rules. Gas and oil will make the planet boil. Climate change. Our kids and grandkids need a healthy place to live. Sustainability requires you and me to take drastic action now to slow down climate change. The planet cannot wait for us to change. From wind and sun, it must be done. To outrun disaster, a healthy place to live. Sustainability requires you and me to take drastic action now.
I'm Marie Martini. I'm from Mount Horeb. I'm the only Raging Granny from Mount Horeb. Incidentally, we welcome all women. All you need is a hat. So, we'd like to have you. I'd like to talk a little bit about, I'm the editor of our book, Listen to Your Grandmothers, and how this book all happened. I've been a Raging Granny since 2007, and I got to know these women incredibly well, and they have such stories. And I started thinking about a year ago, those stories need to be preserved. We're old. We need to have ourselves written down. And our stories represent over seven decades of the lives of women in the United States. Most of us are from the Midwest, but some of us are from other places too. But they represent seven decades that really show how much women's lives and rights and responsibilities have changed. As full disclosure, I'm proud to say that my mother, who can't be here tonight, is also a Raging Granny. So I've had that experience of being with my mother, and she has been singing and marching and protesting and everything else with us through all these years. So that has been a truly wonderful experience for me. The stories that these women tell are all different, but they're all joined together with a common thread. And the common thread is dedication to the common good. These are women who have done what they could through the course of their lives to try to make the world a better place for everybody's grandchild. These are women who became activists recently in Wisconsin. It's been a very tumultuous time. And women who have been activists for their entire lives and had generational activism in their families. So there's been that huge difference. Some women didn't become politically active until they were senior citizens. And that is a really good thing. So I thought these stories need to be preserved, first of all, because they're interesting stories. Again, we're all old. So we've had life experiences, a lot of them. And we've seen pretty much every leaf on every tree. And the question was, how much do we really want to reveal? And that became a pretty big deal for us. I mean, we all have living relatives, and what will our relatives say? And in fact, my own children and several of my sisters, when they read my autobiography, they said, really? That really happened? You really thought that was a... Well, you thought that at that time, and I said, yes. Well, why didn't you tell us? Because we didn't. We kept so much to ourselves. Then they started writing their stories, and it was indeed a painful experience, so we can't get away from that. You start writing the story of your life, and all of these memories come popping up, and some of them aren't so wonderful. Some of them are, a lot of them are, but some of them aren't. And if you read the stories in the book, the 22 autobiographies, you will find that these are women who have gone through and overcome a lot of hardships. Life wasn't just jolly wonderful for all of us. It can't be like that. And they're truthful and they're honest and they're forthcoming and they say, this is what happened in my life. And I believe that that needs to be preserved. So these women have a story to tell. And I think that this represents all of us in this crowd. We all have stories to tell that really should be captured before they're gone. So I urge you to think about it within your own families and within your own set of friendships and start to get people to write their stories down. And try to get them to tell their stories and preserve them somehow. My grandchildren are little yet, But they may not know me later on when they become adults because they're so little, but they will know of me because of these stories. They will know of their great-grandmother because my mother's story is in this book as well. So I urge all of you to think about a project such as this. It's a project that matters. There's all kinds of help out there to try to figure out how to do this. I didn't know a single thing about how to get a book published when I started. All I did was, this is my 44th year of teaching, so I knew how to browbeat people to get their stories in. True, I had to do it nicely. It was awful.
They're awful, they were
so I knew how to get them to get their stories in, but then what do you do with them? I found a publisher in Mineral Point, and she runs her own publishing company, and she walked me through every bit of the way, and I had 1,000 questions 1,000 times, and she was very generous. Then she sent it to a printer, and the printer is in Verona, and that was a woman printer. So we have women's stories, compiled by women, published by a woman, and printed by a publishing company that women run. And I graduated from high school in 1967, and that was not my world then. Women did not do any of those things back in those days. So I'm very happy to see things are changing, and I'm very happy to know all of these people. And if you're interested, we have some books. Thank you.
Do some Q&A. On to the Q&A.
If you have any questions, we would like to listen to your questions and try to answer them if we could. Yes.
Have you guys performed for the legislature yet?
Mighty close.
We did at one point. Senator Feingold and who's this? Oh, a couple of other legislative offices, federal legislative ones. But we sung at public hearings.
Yeah. Right. We think that we might possibly be the reason that they passed a policy that disallowed hats.
Right. So it's not allowed to be at a hearing with a hat.
With a hat on.
We did try to sing at Paul Ryan's office, but he didn't show up. For yes.
How big is your group?
About 30 active grannies, but they come in and come out whenever, because everybody's schedule is really busy, so we call ourselves a gaggle, and we get a gaggle of whomever happens to be available at that time. But we're always interested in other women who would like to join us. You don't have to know how to sing, which is really fortunate for me because I'm just awful. Fortunately, there are a whole bunch of other women here who are good. So all you need is the desire to make a statement in a non-confrontational way. That's how we view what we're doing. Everything that happens right now is so disagreeable and so confrontational, and people are so angry that we decided a long time ago, actually the Raging Grannies began in Canada, we decided a long time ago that the Raging Grannies were going to be non-confrontational. We were going to use humor to try to get views across. And first we have to get people's attention, so that's why we dress like we do. So we're welcoming to other women of a certain age, and we would love to. You don't necessarily have to have a grandchild. We have Raging Grannies who don't have actual grandchildren too. They're the grandmothers of the whole world, like we all are. Anybody else? Yes.
I didn't have a question. I just have a comment to make. You guys are so inspirational. It's really been wonderful hearing you.
Thank you.
Very much.
Well, perhaps we should sing America the Turbulence,
which is our closing song, and you are going to sing the chorus with us.
So we're going to finish with this song. This song was written after the election, and it's not meant to be a downer. It is meant to really think about what's going on and how we want to respond to it.
And Sheila wrote the words.
This one that they sing.
Yes. And please join us for the chorus, which
you have the words.
You have the words for it, yes.
Divided now by choices made with fear left in their way, how do we mend this fracturing?
All right.
Thank you.